And of course, those in Congress that were part of doing the legislation, and the commodity folks and the farm organizations there, they're saying that isn't the way we want it, and they're not liking it.
Yeah, well, this highlights what happens, and I suppose it doesn't happen very often when the administration doesn't like, in this case, a piece of farm legislation. I say it doesn't happen very often because I don't remember the last time an administration vetoed a farm bill.
No.
But that really, then you get into a secondary battle after the fact as to what the implementation is like, and it's the executive branch who has much more control over that. Is there anything that Congress can or does do or tries to do, and examples that Congress can do to make the make the agencies implement the way it feels like it should be implemented?
Yes, they can. And, of course, you know, they do have control over the purse strings, too. So they have a number of ways that they can do it. One of the other examples is the 10-acre rule. And this was a rule that was put in to essentially knock out those folks that were hobby farmers. But in the process of explaining the rule in the conference committee, the folks that put the bill together said that it was fine if a farmer had more than one 10-acre plot and wanted to combine those 10-acre plots, he then would be eligible for the farm program. And if you didn't have 10 acres and you didn't have that situation, then you wouldn't. Well, USDA decided that they wanted to make it such that if it was a 10-acre plot, it wouldn't be eligible. Well, Congress, and I think it's maybe just the House now, but there is legislation that's being put into place, or at least being debated, I probably should say,
mm-hmm.
that would go ahead and require the USDA to do that specifically. So they can come back with legislation that is more pointed and make it and hopefully, you know, get what they want. But it is quite interesting. Of course, the COOL is another one, and that's been around since 2002, and it's still there's still some work that's being done on exactly how to administer that. One of the things that the interim rules that they had set up made it sound like that, you know, just about anything that came through a processing plant could be labeled as from North America, that is, from Canada, U.S., and Mexico, if there had been processing of livestock or cattle from any of those three areas in the last 60 days. Well, that isn't the way the legislation was written, and so there was a lot of consternation about that. And now I think they've rewritten it according to what I see on the web, and it sounds like if there is a livestock item that went through the line during that day, then they could say it was from Mexico or Canada or you know, from North America. But if it was only from the U.S. during that batch that day, well, then they would have to say the U.S. And that's a way of getting around it. But you know, I'm not in the meat processing industry. But even to me, it would occur to me that I could keep a pen of Canadian and Mexican cattle on the premises, and you know, put one or two of those in each day, and get around that if I was so inclined.
Mm-hmm. Let's take up some of the other issues that you've been tackling there at APAC at the University of Tennessee in recent months. And I did go to your website and picked off a couple of things that you have written.
Uh-huh.
One's called Washington Consensus Phase 2. The other is about the World Bank and studies beginning to acknowledge the elephants in the global living room. Which one would you like to take up?
They're somewhat related. I think that we have over time kind of developed a father knows best kind of attitude with developing nations, that, you know, you have to do what we say, and if you don't, we won't loan you money, and we don't really care what your specific situation is. We're going to give you the same recipe no matter what, and those recipes are somewhat hard for them to handle. They include such things as privatizing many of the industries, and some of those industries aren't even privatized in the U.S., such as waterworks and that kind of thing. Going for free markets, getting the government out of various kinds of activities and other kinds of things that are good, except that perhaps are not really that appropriate at the particular stage of development of that country, or shouldn't or couldn't be done quite as quickly as they would want it to be. And I think that we're recognizing now that some of those things are probably too pat, and that we need to take into account the situation in the individual country. And one of the reasons for that is because it hasn't been working all that well. Many of the countries that we haven't been involved in with that kind of a prescription via the World Bank or IMF, such as China and other countries in the Asia, have been growing very quickly, and the countries that we have been using that prescription haven't done as well.
Well, why does this involve agriculture in the United States in any way?
Well, agriculture, I think, is important for us to understand that growing other countries' income is going to make markets available to agriculture in the long run. And if we don't do it right, why, we probably are going to suffer the consequences in agriculture as well as in other ways.
You cite something from the Economist Voice, an article that, and you'll have to forgive me, an economist from Harvard and the John F. Kennedy School of Government. I think the name is Danny Roderick, but I'm not sure that that's pronounced right. Why did you do that, and what does he say that you found of interest?
Well, he was saying that he thought that we ought to recognize that economics are extremely important, but other kinds of considerations sometimes come into the decision makers of countries, not just our developing countries, but our country as well, and that we need to try to assimilate and come up with a more holistic kind of approach to dealing with other countries rather than one that is only based on income, because sometimes that income isn't distributed all that equally. And, you know, we can increase the per capita incomes, but if only 5% of them are getting the income, and, of course, you divide by any population number, it looks like it's the per capita incomes are increasing, but actually you might have a very polarized situation in terms of income. So he's thinking that we need to look at these countries individually and help them get to the point that they can get to a takeoff stage, and each of them may have a little different help they need rather than a standard one that we apply to everybody.
Well, what kind of prescription would you prescribe then for developing these nations so that agricultural markets could at some point over the long term come out of them and there might be exports from the U.S. to them?
Well, I think that we have to recognize that many countries have a large proportion of their population in agriculture, and it's going to take a while for the job opportunities in cities to catch up, so that if you do things too quickly, you would put a bunch of folks out of work. So. And essentially increase the size of slums in many of the cities. So I think you have to help them become educated, get as best you can, work on infrastructure, work on education, work on making them more productive. And as there are jobs that are available in the cities that can pull the folks off more gradually rather than real quickly, I think that is going to be our best bet. In some ways, Russia did a shock treatment on theirs, and everything kind of fell apart. But other countries like Asia are trying to do it more gradually.
We'll continue our conversation in just 2 minutes, okay?
Okay.
Darrell Ray is with the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. Joins us here on the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Mark Report. More with Darrell Ray in just 2 minutes.
WILL programs are made possible by Pages for All Ages, books, music, cafe, and DVDs in Savoy. A locally owned independent bookstore, Pages' goal is to provide a full-service store with a comfortable setting for customers' enjoyment. In Savoy or on the web at www.pagesforallages.com.
Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region, Illinois and Indiana, looks like, as provided by our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. He says tonight in Illinois, skies will be mostly cloudy, a few scattered showers during the evening, then clearing overnight. In Indiana, mostly cloudy, scattered showers primarily before midnight. Lows will range from 45 in northwestern Illinois to 56 in the south. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sunshine, breezy and cooler. A chance of a few showers in northern Indiana. Highs tomorrow from 60 in northern Illinois to 70 in the south. The extended forecast says cooler weather is arriving. High temps on Wednesday are expected to be mostly in the upper 50s and 60s, and the 60s and 70s on Thursdays. Lows on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday morning should mostly be in the 40s. In a few of those normally colder spots in the very far northern reaches of the two-state area, a few lows in the mid to the upper 30s areas are possible. No widespread frost or freeze expected this week. A moderation in temperature expected late into the weekend, and dry weather expected Wednesday through Saturday with a chance of showers again and thunderstorms returning on Sunday of this coming week.
Today's programs are made possible with support from the Champaign County Humane Society, promoting animal welfare since 1951. Pet adoptions are available from the Humane Society, a proud member of Community Shares of Illinois, a choice for payroll donation at work, on the web at cs-il.org.
You're listening to the Closing Marker Report. This is the Harvest Hour edition. We're talking with agricultural policy expert from APAC. That's the Agricultural Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. The chair's name is Daryl Ray. Daryl, thanks for being with us again this afternoon. Let's continue our conversation about agricultural policy. What are the new issues you see developing over the next decade?
I think that we will be moving towards more concentration and focus on conservation and the environment than we have in the last decade, although we've made many movements in that direction already. But I think that we are still in a situation where stability of the agricultural sector is something that we have to be concerned about. At one time, agriculture's productivity and overcapacity, we would say, was often due to the developed countries like the U.S. and Canada and Australia and EU. But now we're in a time in which supplies are tight, and we know that part of that is due to the increase in ethanol demand. Some of the other reasons include reductions in output in certain countries. But I think that with the kinds of prices that we've seen over the last 18 months or 2 years, we're going to see a lot of increase in acreage in places like the Ukraine and Brazil, and it's going to encourage productivity and research for technological advance in various countries. So, and we also know that the private sector is very much into increasing the yields for corn and other commodities. So I think that in the future we have to worry about the productivity and maybe even excess productivity, but it's not necessarily as much created by the developed world as it is by the developing world, such as Brazil and other countries around the world. So I know I hear people say that, we won't have to worry about low prices anymore. We're at a different plateau. And that could be true, especially if inflation hits the rest of the economy and stays there. But I'm not. But I wouldn't. I wouldn't necessarily say that will occur. And of course, we have a lot of increase in input costs. That even if prices do stay fairly high, but not as high as they have been, yields are going to have to increase substantially in order for farmers to have a net income that is reasonable. So I think we're going to continue to have some of the same problems that we've had historically. But I think we'll probably move more towards environmental concerns as well.
Well, and will that be necessitated if the rest of the world, for instance, if Ukraine and other places were able to ramp up, and I don't know whether I'd say dramatically, but to increase to their potential in previous years, would that by necessity mean that there needs to be a way to put green payments into the U.S. farm economy to sustain it?
It's possible that would be one way of handling it. I guess it depends on how serious the ups and downs are. I worry that, you know, with the tremendous increases that we've seen in prices for major commodities, that we're going to be paying for it dearly in 4 or 5 years. And if the prices get down into the levels that we've seen, you know, not that long ago of $1.50 corn and, you know, $4 wheat or $4 soybeans or even lower, I'm not sure that there will be any green payments or direct payments that would be large enough to offset that kind of reduction in revenue. So I think it would be a combination probably of some of the efforts that have been made before plus green payments. Now, if it's a relatively balanced situation in terms of supply and demand over time, then I would think that we could move more to the kinds of the payments that we see in Europe. But I'm not sure that that's a guaranteed situation.
So on your thoughts then, the cycles back and forth would be cycling to the bottom side potentially for the farm economy, but that it wouldn't be related at all to the food v. fuel debate in terms of there would be plenty of room because of overproduction for corn to be continued to use for ethanol. Is that right?
To some extent. I guess I do think that that corn is kind of a stepping stone. We'll have to see if that's true, but I suspect that with all the money that is being put into the cellulosic effort, that we will probably see before as long as, you know, maybe sooner than some would expect, increases in volume and, in terms of making it more efficient to use cellulose as a form of feedstock for ethanol. So I kind of suspect that, you know, the use of corn for ethanol is going to level off in about 2 years, probably stay there unless we see, you know, tremendous cost reductions with cellulose. But I suspect that it'll stay fairly flat, and then in order to reach the kind of mandated levels that we have after that will probably require cellulose to make up the difference.
It's been a pleasure to talk.